welcome to The Architects on RN Summer with Stuart Harrison, Simon Knott and myself, Christine Phillips. We're normally on 3RRR in Melbourne and we're here on RN Summer for the next few weeks to talk all things buildings, places and urban design. We've got a big show lined up for you today talking about innovation. What is innovation and how are architects being innovative? I suppose the short answer to this might lie in new digital technologies, but today we're going to focus on innovative forms of architectural practice and what sorts of projects architects are working on that fall outside the usual sorts of commissions like houses and public buildings. We'll look at collaborations along with other innovations in making and commissioning architecture. So we're going to begin the show with an interview we did with Kevin Carmody, a director and co-founder of London-based practice Carmody Grawk, and the extraordinary range of projects their practice have worked on over the last few years. We'll then play an interview we did with Kittel Thorsen from Oslo-based practice Snøhetta, who take an innovative approach to relationships between landscape and architecture. And finally, we'll conclude with an interview with a very interesting architect, Anna Tweedale, who is an architect, urbanist and artist based between Melbourne and Europe and works well beyond the limits of what we might imagine conventional architectural practice to be. But first we thought we'd ask ourselves about the sorts of innovations we've come across in architecture. Simon, have you noticed any really extraordinary innovations in architecture lately?
Well, Christine, I think, you know, when we sort of talk about innovation in architectural practice, I think probably one of the biggest things that's happened over the last 10 years or so, particularly, you know, obviously this millennium has been the advent of computers and what they've meant to the way in which we design buildings, the way we document them and the way that they're produced. And, you know, I think you guys have probably all been part of this both within the education system, but, you know, from a practice perspective, we've gone from, in my time as an architect, I was taught to draw on a drawing board with a set square and a paraline and pen and ink, and then moved into computers and AutoCAD. And fundamentally what happened at the initial stages of computer-aided design or CAD, computer-aided design, is that we took the drawing board and translated that into three-dimensional space. So basically the initial forms of software became just a translation of that set square and the X and Y coordinates and put that into a computer space. So it really was just taking the existing modes of production and then making them electronic. Whereas what we've seen the last couple of years is a move away from that. So fundamentally what you're doing when you're documenting a building is taking something that's imagining it in a 3D form. So you might build a model of it, a physical model or something else, or do some hand sketches. And then you translate it out into a two-dimensional plane. So you draw some sections, plans, elevations. And then the builder has to reinterpret those two-dimensional drawings back into a three-dimensional form. So what we've seen the last couple of years is a complete reinvention of the way we might document buildings, and it's referred to as parametric design. And what we get with that is a new form of computer-aided design where we're actually building, rather than doing a two-dimensional drawing of a building, we're actually build a 3D computer model of it. So it's in virtual space, you're building this computer model of it, and that's been done for a while now. But these models have all the information within them, so they're a highly sophisticated piece of information. They have all the wall thicknesses, what they're actually made of, all the details are embedded within these. And so it means that when you're finished building this 3D model, it will just automatically cut all the planned sections, elevations. And this just derives a whole, and it might seem like a fairly, that it may not have a big change, but it really makes for a radical difference in the way that we can understand buildings. And then that's taken on further into the way we actually produce them. So people like Frank Gehry, for instance, in Spain with the Bilbao Museum, he pioneered a whole new way of delivering those projects where the 3D model was actually then transferred across to the fabricators of the steelwork and everything that these sort of crazy three-dimensional forms and these quite extravagant architectural forms can then be fabricated in something that couldn't have been done before, in a way that couldn't have been done before. So what we're seeing is a radical transformation in the way in which we can deliver buildings and a whole new possibilities in what we can do with architectural form.
And I think, Simon, that transition is still ongoing, very much so. I mean, a lot of buildings, and also as a practitioner, a lot of projects are still delivered in a traditional method. Mm. But there are particularly big projects now being delivered in the way you've just outlined, particularly with applications such as Revit, which is parametric modeling software. And I think in the practice world at the moment, everyone's transitioning to that, to this, knowing that the future is there. We know what the future looks like now, but the transition will take another 10 years, I would say.
I think at least, I mean, we've sort of, I think the building industry is traditionally very slow to move across to new technologies. And fundamentally, I mean, you know, up until sort of 10 years ago, we really still build as though, you know, as the way the Romans did. You know, it's pretty much sort of sticks and mud and, you know, and things out of the earth. And there's not a lot of the digital fabrication and the way that's starting to transform, and prefabrication is really starting to transform the industry, is really, as you say, Stuart, just in its infancy. But what we are seeing is things like, you know, if you could take a model, you can give it across to all your consultants, so all the engineers and everyone else can use the same model, so we get a whole lot of errors being driven out of the process. So a lot of big developers and big building companies are interested in using this technology, because a whole lot of mistakes are eliminated. And on projects like the big museums and those sort of large-scale, like the casinos or those billion-dollar projects, hospitals, there are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of drawings that are produced for those projects. So to get them all coordinated and exactly right, it's an enormous task. And there's people, there's teams within offices that, whose jobs are just to make sure that those drawings all sit together. So that'll eliminate a lot of errors, but also provide new possibilities in the way we might build things. Because, I mean, what they're doing in America with the steelwork is, once it's been, the metal goes across to the fabricator, it's all built by robots, so CAD-CAM cut. So in the steel processing plant, it's all computer controlled, the processing and manufacture of the steelwork. It's barcoded and then is sent out to site and GPS'd into place through a crane. So you can actually go from the 3D model, which is in virtual space, will take, fabricate the steelwork and then lift it up in a crane and brought into its place on the building in a GPS world. So the system, the whole process is almost becoming completely digitised and mechanised.
And Christine, there's parallels in the education world as well.
Yeah, I was trained at RMIT in Melbourne in the early 90s, and now I'm back there teaching, and I've seen a huge change in technology. And yes, it is to do with these parametric systems, but also the vast amount of tools that students have to help model up their ideas. So we've got things like 3D printers now, where you can plug in a computer file and you get this amazing, beautiful 3D model that's emerging. It is a very slow process, so it's not as easy as it sounds, but that's just one of the amazing tools.
The 3D printer actually makes a physical, three-dimensional
physical
object.
Model, and we also have there now this great new robot, which is yet to be implemented, which will do larger scales, three-dimensional models based on the same idea of plugging in a 3D computer file, and you get this great three-dimensional model built by the robot. And I think what that's allowed students to do is, one, articulate their ideas in a much more complex way, so they're able to generate really interesting forms that, I suppose, the hand doesn't necessarily allow you to do unless you've got extraordinary talents. So this is a really great move forward in communicating. And I think at the end of the day, this is going to help architects better communicate with clients and with communities who don't necessarily understand how to read architectural drawings. They can see in these sorts of new ways in computer drawings, in these amazing models that are able to build really intricate three-dimensional forms in new.
And it's almost, the idea of prototyping has gone to a whole new level too within the office as an extension of that, because we can actually test out little pieces of buildings at one-to-one
exactly,
scale and very quickly, and it's becoming more and more affordable. And these, only a few years ago, these printers were worth millions of dollars, and now they're coming down to almost an affordable stage.
Well, they're becoming like actual printers, though. They'll be domestically applicable soon.
And I think this is coming up as perhaps one of the biggest changes to our society, not just in architecture, but in a whole range of different things. And because what it is actually doing is giving the everyday person the ability to manufacture. And it's having some alarming consequences, because I was reading the other day the ability to actually print guns now has become a big problem, because there's a whole lot of material out on the internet where you can actually download and print out everything you need to make a gun. There's not just one small component that you can't actually print that you need to do that, but you can buy that online, well, apart from the bullets. But it will be, you know, certainly in the next few years, very easy to print a whole series of things.
And Christine, in relation to innovation, I think in terms of what I sort of have seen also in my, I guess, time as a graduate over the last 10 years or so, is I guess, of the way in which we've changed the way we work as architects, and I think that our interviews today will touch on that quite a bit, but also in the way architecture and the media have begun to intermingle, and that relationship, as it has in the wider media, has changed quite a lot. You see a sort of new breed of architect who's a lot more engaged with media, with social media, with traditional media, and I think that also is part of a sort of communication thing, and also improves, you know, abilities to communicate with clients and communities as well. But I think the way in which we see and perceive the architect, both as a sole author, has changed, and also as someone who's separated from, I guess, wider issues of media and engagement. I think that's also beginning to change quite a lot too, and I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Architects on RN Summer. And our first interview is with Kevin Carmody from Carmody Grok. Kevin's originally from Australia, and he's now based in London, where he set up practice with Andrew Grok in 2006. And it's a practice that's become very well known internationally. Like many innovative practices, they've made their name through winning quite a few major architectural competitions, which have led them to complete all sorts of interesting permanent and temporary projects, from a steamboat museum to a temporary dining pavilion, to a few very special memorial commissions, alongside your more traditional architectural jobs like houses. We began by asking Kevin Carmody how these great projects have manifested themselves from beginning to end.
I guess our work over in London has been working in the periphery of architecture, predominantly with temporary projects and a little bit with artists as well. We see this really as a way of testing some of the ideas that we take towards a permanent architecture in our practice, and I guess they also give us the opportunity to build things quickly and at a larger scale than you're often given the opportunity to as a young architect.
Yeah, some of the temporary projects are really interesting, ones that have ranged from being up for 5 days, the London Architecture Festival one, to one that was really well known, the cafeteria, the restaurant, pop-up restaurant project, the name of which I've completely forgotten.
Studio East Dining, yeah.
Which I think got a lot of press internationally. Do you want to talk a bit about that project, because that was on the site of the Olympics?
It was actually on the car park roof adjacent to the Olympic site, kind of looking west across the Olympics back towards central London. We were given only sort of 10 weeks from first briefing to opening night of that project, and I have to say it started out as a commission to kind of put a wedding tent on the roof and us dress the inside of the tent as kind of interior decoration almost. Within a week or two, we'd convinced the client that we could build it out of materials we found on the site, predominantly scaffolding.
A full project.
Yeah, we sort of invented a project out of that commission, and I think that's something we're quite interested in. I think every opportunity to build something is I guess an opportunity for the studio to test an idea, and if you push that hard enough and you're not complacent about it, hopefully you can get something out of that.
And we talked a little bit about this idea with Peter Rich earlier about the concept of sort of necessity and what that drives in good architecture. And I think that most really good architects do make something good out of a, you know, limited means, and something, you know, seeing opportunities. And I think that, you know, you're just sort of forced into certain situations and doing work like that sort of project that others might just walk away from. Do you think that's a sort of really good grounding for architecture, to kind of do that level of inquiry and interrogation?
Certainly in England, we find that a lot of the young architects are complacent about the opportunities they're given, and more importantly, they sort of expect it to land on their plate. You know, given kind of 5 or 7 years of architectural training, they're kind of sitting there saying, I deserve this now. And I don't think our studio has ever taken that view, actually. We've gone the other way and said, well, bloody well build it, even if they don't want, because we if we're not continually moving forward and testing ideas, then the kind of the idea of the studio as a body of work rather than a series of projects kind of dies, becomes stagnant.
And I guess one type that you've been associated with your office quite strongly since you formed is the type of the memorial. A series of those, the London bombings memorial, very very successful, and really interesting to see the tsunami memorial, which is a great, simple idea.
I think we were we were hesitant to take on a second memorial project. I have to say that they're emotional things, and they're very difficult things to get right. When we took that commission on, we kind of agreed with the families that it was commemorating an event more than perhaps the particular people that it was sort of commissioned by, which were the British victims. It's more important that this was one significant event in the world's history, and we took a singular thing to represent that.
And which is just a large rock.
We talked in the lecture about the idea of imbricated rock forms, and I think it's a bloody interesting natural recording of the Earth's history, where there's been a series of tsunamis over time, and rocks have been displaced several kilometres up cliff faces, and we know from dating those rocks that there was, you know, 150 AD, there was a very large tsunami that hit the west coast of Ireland, and the idea of just displacing a rock, showing the kind of gravity and force of nature, and just trying to move this rock across Europe, 120 tonnes, I think I said it was the second largest rock ever to come to London, yes, after Cleopatra's Needle.
I mean, I guess through that work and then sort of following on to some of the larger commissions you've got now, the boat museum we saw last there too, there's obviously this sort of idea of meaning in architecture. And I just wonder, how do you approach the idea of meaning in your work?
I think it was something we became interested in at the 7 July Memorial, and that is how through a way of making you can instill meaning. And I think we touched on the idea of taking a sand casting, which is a very, very, you know, ancient technique of forming metal, and pouring molten hot metal into a kind of formed cast that is an open casting process. So it allows each casting to develop its own kind of personality and qualities. And I have to say, most of that is about trying to engage the visitor, them sort of seeing the unusual qualities of that. And it's really wonderful that the memorial itself is becoming stained from so many people touching it, between kind of eye level and chest level, where people almost in a kind of magnetic way are drawn to kind of engage with the memorial in that way.
I'm kind of just in an idea, and you touched on this about someone making a comment, you know, you never do a good building until you're 50 as an architect. And I think, you know, to some extent that is true because there's a lot to learn. And I think most good architects, and whether it was Peter Rich or Snoeta or those guys, have all started in these quite fine little projects because you learn to sort of deal with things that are these sort of small details. And is that something you're conscious of in your work?
I have to say it is. I think the normal trajectory for a young practice, certainly in London, is to do kind of small house extensions. And once you get enough of those, you might get a new build house. And then after that, you might start to get considered for public work. We followed that same trajectory. We just haven't maybe talked about. And so we've got some really sweet little house projects going on. We did a small extension for Julian Opie, the artist, and we're doing at the moment a new build house in North London. And these are kind of the crafted, small, you know, deal with waterproofing, deal with all the heaviness of architecture at a smaller scale, which develop up towards maybe, say, the Windermere Steamboat Museum that we're now looking at. You know, our studio's grown to sort of 20 people, and with that growth over sort of 5 years, we've developed a team that have been there since the beginning.
Yes, you're listening to The Architects on RN, and that was an interview with Kevin Carmody from London-based Carmody Gawke, who really are very interesting architectural practice. And as we discussed there, getting a series of really interesting commissions, and as Kevin said, on the periphery of architecture, particularly memorial work, which is incredibly, incredibly interesting stuff that's not traditionally regarded, I guess, as stuff done by architects.
No, and really a rising star, I think, internationally. And you know, it's great to see Australian people overseas that are making a name for themselves.
Educated at ANU in Canberra and RMIT in Melbourne before moving to London quite a few years ago now, and doing great work over there.
And next up, we've got it's a real treat, this one. They're one of my favourite architects, Snoeta. They're from Norway. And quite often in when we've been interviewing these big international stars, when you actually meet them in the flesh, it's somewhat disappointing, but this is certainly not the case with Kittel Thorson. He's one of the principals of Snøhetta, and we were really impressed when we met him, what a genuinely warm person he was, and how much he had to say about architecture. They started their practice following the winning competition for the New Alexandria Library. Some years ago now, that was back in the early 90s, I think. And then
it took 10 years or so for it to be built, didn't it?
Yeah, it's a long time. And then have recently been involved in some really significant projects and perhaps becoming really well known internationally for the World Trade Center Memorial, which they won through a competition process again.
The pavilion at the memorial, yes. The building part, not the big black holes.
No, that's correct. And there was a number of different processes around that, and a kind of complex political processes we'll get to a little bit. And we started by asking him about the pressure involved in working on that Ground Zero project and whether it was easier working from a more peripheral country like Norway.
The Ground Zero project, the memorial pavilion, has been more complex maybe than anything else that we've done because of its political situation, quite obviously, and because of the traumatic memories that are connected to a place like that. So that, for us, then, is more about, less about design and more about negotiation. So you almost negotiate the building into place, you know, instead of designing it. And these type of complexities that you have when they get public, they are really hard to describe. You know, a newspaper wouldn't understand whether you've negotiated a building or designed a building. Mm. So to some extent, then you have to make that building intuitively represent what you've just been through. And I think the Ground Zero building is a clear example of that. It is possible to show negotiation as design, for instance. It's quite nice to be in the periphery, obviously, because you're not suffering from the same pressure. When it comes to colleagues or, let's say, contemporary opinions that might be intellectually described by certain people, and you're sort of out of the good company if you don't follow it. So we don't feel directed. And coming from the periphery, we feel we have more freedom to react towards the things that we actually suggest. And that means also that the internal conversations in the office are more free.
There's a certain beauty in your work, and there's also a very distinctive formal approach, and you can see that in some of the major projects. The other one, of course, being the Opera House. Do you want to talk a bit about, in Oslo, do you want to talk a bit about how that came about and how that tries to engage with its quite unique landscape and context?
Yes, I mean, since 87, we've been working on this intersection between buildings and landscapes, be it water, be it sky, and be it ground. And this sort of definition of new borderlines between the two, like the roof as the fifth facade, and how you sort of develop architectures that become, let's call them for easy sake, ground scrapers in a way. What do you do with horizontality, which is publicly accessible? And the opera was the last in a series where we actually had the opportunity to be generous enough to give the whole site back to the city. So you actually have the footprint of an opera house, but you can use that footprint twice. Use it once for the functions of the opera house, and on the other hand, you use it for a more urban, hard surface constellation of possible movement by the public. And I think this type of, let's say, public generosity generates better public ownership to certain things. And in the end, this building is for the public. So I think, for the sake of the opera, it is kind of interesting to see how it has been used.
The plaza.
Yeah, the plaza on top. Mm. You know, more than last year, more than 2 million people visited that roof, which makes it the most visited place in Oslo. And from that point of view, we designed something that seemingly was a necessity at that point in time, rather than generating. We didn't create the necessity, but we just reacted on a contemporary situation. And from that point of view, we didn't generate a new land. Well, we generated a new landscape, but it's not an abstract landscape anymore because it's a new thing. It's something real in itself. So in a way, it's a mix between landscape and the plaza.
It's hard to pin down exactly what it is.
Well, and that's a really transformative thing then, isn't it? Because, I mean, what impact does that have on say, the opera itself, which I can't imagine is probably a fairly sort of, you know, generally obscure thing in mainstream society, has suddenly become
the most visited place in the capital. Is that what has that had a big impact on who they are and what the way they're seen?
Yeah, I mean, altogether, it has to do with slow education. You know, architecture is transformative, as you say, but on a very slow basis. So what happens is that a lot of people that make love on the roof now will be those visiting the Opera House in 5 years.
I mean, the other course precedent for that idea of a transformative opera house and a public space is the Sydney Opera Houses, and there's a very strong parallel between those two projects. Is that something you looked at, the Sydney Opera House, also Scandinavian in its authorship?
Sure. We looked especially at the Sydney Opera House before it was finished.
Yes.
If you see the construction...
Where it's just the landscape.
Exactly. If you see the early stages before these things come up, and you see the Sydney Opera House, you will find some similarities.
I wanted to ask you a slightly more pragmatic question. I'm interested in this as a director of my own practice too. How you manage to, you've got work in San Francisco and New York, got an office in New York, you've got an office in Norway, 100 plus staff. How do you actually manage to do all that and maintain, an obvious level of integrity and design in the project? So that must be a hard task.
And come and tell us about it.
Yes.
Well, I think it's a misconception to believe that there is the master architect anymore. I think the complexity of architecture is demanded by cooperative authorship. And that actually means that it's more about the dynamics of the processes, which means you can be in control of a lot more than you can be as a person. So basically 1 + 1 is a lot more than 2. And that, in essence, is the clue. If you accept that perfectionism is not within your own body, but within the body of maybe 10 or 15 or 20 or 100, then you have a chance of doing more than what you could do on your own.
And you're listening to the Architects on RN, and that was Hetal Thorsen from Praktis Snøhetta, very interesting architect, and we spoke to him some time ago, and what a really, really kind of smart guy he was.
Passionate, and the work they do is really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and we should say he just stepped off a plane from Norway too, so he'd sort of come straight into the conference and really open and did a number of interviews, and I thought he was a fantastic guy.
And also, I guess, operating at a series of very particular practice conditions, very unique projects, obviously no more politically charged in Ground Zero, and with that fantastic Oslo Opera House as well, and now kind of one of the key tourist attractions in his home country of Norway. Christine, who are we hearing from next?
Next up, we've got an interview we did with Anna Tweedale, and I'm a big fan of Anna. She's a bit of a Renaissance woman. She's an architect, she's an urbanist, and she's an artist. And she's based in Melbourne and also does a lot of work in Europe. And I think what I love about Anna is just her capacity to work in all sorts of different fields. She's a practicing architect. She collaborates with artists. She writes. She's an educator. And when we met up with Anna, she'd just recently returned from working in Granada, where she'd been working on a architectural competition called EuroPan. So we began by asking her what that was and what her involvement with EuroPan was.
Well, it's a Europe-wide competition for emerging architects, which they frame for as architects under 40, which is quite realistic and generous, I think. And basically, they choose a number of sites. They choose a theme. They have a large organisation across Europe, and then they have an organisation in each country. They choose a number of sites. There's usually around 40 sites across the continent. As an entrant, you can choose to enter one or more sites if you want, but only ever one per country. And basically, it's quite an intensive competition. There's a lot of work, and they're usually to do with housing and urbanism. So they're quite large sites. They're not individual buildings.
And the idea is that some of them might actually become built projects.
Well, the idea is that most of them become built projects. Mm. I think the ratio they talk about is about 50% end up being built projects in the end, which is a really good
rate.
Which
is pretty good, right?
It's great.
It's a big competition.
Yeah. And the idea being that it's supportive of younger architects and helping to get
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the entire point of the competition, is to have a situation where they can put young up-and-coming architects in contact with problem sites around Europe. So this are two aspects to it. One is about bringing emerging architects onto the scene and giving the opportunities to take their work to another level, to a larger level. But at the same time, it's also an opportunity every 2 years. It's a biannual competition. But basically, it's an opportunity as well for Europe to have a discussion about the sorts of problems in a thematic way, the sorts of problems that the cities are facing.
But yeah, and this European competition, just to keep on that for a second, Anna, you'd had a go at that before, involved in that process, and this time you got something in the process, as you did last time, I think.
No, the first time didn't get anything. I worked just as a student, so I was living in Berlin as a student in about 11 years ago, and worked on a team, which was for the European 6, that was 2000, year 2000, and so now 12 years ago. And this year, we got a highly commended for our project, and I was working in collaboration with an architect in Granada. So our site was actually in the north of Spain in Bilbao that we selected, but I worked in Granada with José Luis Muñoz, my collaborator, in a studio where there are actually two other teams also working on Europan at the same time, and we had quite a great success because the other two teams actually both won their sites.
So on the issue of economics, I wanted to touch on this because I know you have a strong interest in this, and this is about getting involved in projects a lot earlier than we tend to as design professionals. Do you talk a bit about how you've encountered this world of the sort of sketchy world of project economics?
I got involved in that a few years ago and have been collaborating particularly with particularly one firm of economists and planners, urban economists. But the reason that I got involved in this is I started to realise that a lot of the important decisions about buildings are already made by the time that an architect gets brought onto a project, and that in order to affect the built environment in the way that communities want to actually use them, you need to get involved into that early part of project decision making, which is It was really interesting for me. I learned a lot from working with economists and planners and the sort of consultants who are doing that sort of work, who are often doing the work for governments and local councils and community groups before architects. It's basically defining the project before architects get brought into it.
Yeah, it sort of raises that issue of the brief, doesn't it? Because when we get the sort of project as architects, the briefed project, all those key decisions you say have been made. And some of them aren't very good, but it's too late to challenge them because the site's been decided, the sort of mix of things going into it and the engagement.
Absolutely.
And it does seem unusual that architects haven't actually gone into this territory before, but, I mean, have you found that...
I don't think that's the case. I think there are a number of architects who are involved in that territory. Yeah. But I don't think we're having enough dialogue about that territory.
Right.
Absolutely, because... I think there's a lot of situations, for instance, where the way that money is being distributed by the government indirectly then affects the sort of brief you get in a community building, because they'll say there's a grant that's available for this sort of work, and so a community group will frame their application for funding based on the sort of funding that's available, and that will actually dictate what the brief for the building becomes. And it has nothing to do with what they really need or what the site needs or a whole lot of different other factors.
Do you want to talk about some of the writing you do and how you see that fitting into some of your other works and more sort of conventional architectural ideas or ways of thinking about architecture?
Yeah, well, for me, I think that, for me, writing and teaching now, I've been teaching for a few years now, both of those are absolutely integral to my thinking about, as I was talking about before, cities and architecture and the way development occurs and all of these things I'm interested in. And the relationship that I found most productive is that projects need to be about being projects, and they don't need to be laden with a whole lot of other conceptual ideas at the time that you're working on them. The project just needs to be about what it is. Often you go into it in, if it's a project you're starting on your own, you go into it with some sort of instinct about what it needs to be. Yeah. And that's a process. This is where the word elaboration comes from, is the process of making or articulating something that you don't maybe understand to start with is a process for me of elaboration. And obviously I'm interested in spatial, in space, elaboration that happens in space or in making and building. So spatial elaboration comes from that. So this process is sort of elaborating things through a project. And then there's a sort of a parallel thing that's constantly happening, which is about writing and teaching and talking and dialogue. And it's about then understanding what you're doing in parallel or after the fact or before the fact, but understanding that those two things are still separate in some way. They inform each other, but they're different.
You're listening to The Architects on RN.
And that was an interview with Anna Tweedale, who I'm a very big fan of. She's a co-director of Studio Apparatus with Gretchen Wilkins. And, look, she's just a really talented architect who works on all sorts of interesting collaborations. And as you heard in the interview, she's done a lot of work in Europe and she's also based in Melbourne.
Yeah, I think she's close to that new model of architect I talked a bit about before. Across several disciplines, able to collaborate, as you say, and geographically complexly located as well. You know, sort of, you know, present sort of in many places at different times sometimes. So, really interesting mode of operation, and it'll be interesting to see if that becomes a more popular model over time. I think it probably will be.
And we're going to play you a track now from one of my favourite Australian hip-hop bands, The Curse of Dialect, and this is a track called Speeding Ticket in Colorado.
Californian ill informed, populous, popular, binocular, no one's stopping us. You are something to us, something to me. I'm Indian, American, barbarian, new millennium, left wing. Things pull me to the test, I'll sing, swing from city to city, bitty witty conversation, sensitive, sensing king, sense the gigs we play, they stay a witness, fitness independent, never pretending to send the traveling, spiritual, radical, ridicule, hip hop, ethnic, suburban, turban, turbulence, winds we sense, ghetto scenes, homelessness, a sad damn man resting in Mexican surroundings, sounding nice, spicy, rising, twice, white, I'm island, darling, starting friendship, prescriptions, Egyptian, Basque, Syrian, Jewish, chameleon, feeling the drifting, shape shifting, lifting, reptilian, awareness, prepared, listen, this argument, if incentive, in no penis, in love with a new life, rolling, good, Hollywood, greenery, scenery, Venus, beach, I'm circle, first off, fist on, you stop, freestyle, medallion, Macedonian, stallion, Italian, upper class, no time left, righteous, I'm blind, such a pretty book, goodbyes, I should fly.
We don't have to be Americans. We have our culture, we have our life. I think we have to consider all those things.
10 guys, 4 bands in a hire van. Packed like sardines, smells of all man. Don't buckle up, leave your seatbelts undone. First and best, dress right, shotgun. Play iPod or spin CDs. Rotate music, keep cool, please. For 3 weeks, the road was my home. Got an hour pass that I spent alone. To a manager, give me the shit. He's an arrogant chap and a sarcastic prick. Major cities to college towns, miles pass, tweet around. Extra the next sound check and show. No time for groupies, we're off to Chicago. Eating and sleeping was a luxury. Decent food and bed, no longer an necessity. Trucks that pick away up for accommodation. Sacrifices made for my occupation. This is the life of an artist, tired and hungry, still I persist. This is the life of an artist, tired and hungry, still I persist. This is the life of an artist, tired and hungry, still I persist. This is the life of an artist, tired and hungry, still I persist.
From all the good is
the Golden Gates of Palestinian mates united since the West Coast had barely a taste. Basking in the sun with an Oklahoma badge in my utopian vision of the world manufactured to a piece of plastic. To the north, analyzing the world dilemma, I've come to the source of the power and the greed, planting curse and seed. Cause the dialect, non-ignorance machine, be full of Latino sweets and soul food. Elemental positive news inspired by the touring mood. Omaha, Seattle, the Vans, Bamba, San Diego, apple flavored tobacco, lava lung like volcanoes.
And You're listening to The Architects on RN Summer with Stuart Harrison, Simon Knott and myself, Christine Phillips. That was a great track called Speeding Ticket in Colorado from my very favourite Australian hip-hop band, Cursive Dialect, which they did in 2006. And today we've been talking all about innovation in architecture. We heard from three very talented architects. We started with an interview from Kevin Carmody from Carmody Grok, a London-based practice, and that was followed through with an interview from Norwegian architect Kittel Thorsen from a great practice called Snøhetta. And we finished up there with an interview with Anna Tweedale, who is a co-director of Studio Apparatus with Gretchen Wilkins.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I think the way in which those are being innovative is in relation to kind of how they work, as opposed to, say, necessarily the technological stuff we're identifying at the start of the show. But I think there are two branches of innovation that are worth elaborating on. But they're all working in a very interesting contemporary way, Simon.
Yes, and I think one of the big things that comes out, and there's a lot of lip service paid to this, is an idea of collaboration and what that is. And I think Kettle Thorsen really sort of nailed it well and quite articulately when he said that the whole idea of, you know, being able to practice across these sort of boundaries and internationally is about these ideas of processes and that it's not about one author, it's not about a single person.
No, absolutely.
And I think it's really actually a sort of old modernist idea in a lot of ways and probably before that, where the architect was the kind of hero or the person that was he did the design and it was sort of handed off to the minions. And
that was typically a he too.
Yes, it was. And they developed it up and built the building. Whereas what we understand now in architectural practice is it is collaboration not just amongst an architectural practice but quite often amongst a number of architectural practices, a number of consultants, a number of government agencies to deliver a project, particularly complex political projects and complex public buildings, and perhaps no more complex politically and in terms of its meaning than the Ground Zero or the World Trade Center Memorial Site, which Snøhetta have been working on. And that's
incredibly politically loaded. And
yeah, it's still a decade on. It's still. I don't think it's completely resolved. There's still a lot of conjecture about what that is and whether it was the right thing to do there.
But I mean, just returning to this idea of innovation, Christine, do you think change will continue to occur in the way people work in addition to technology, which inevitably always does change?
I think so. I think architects have realised that there's a lot of value in working with other people, and not just, as you say, Simon, within a practice, but as Anna Tweedale fantastically does, is she actually actively seeks out different people or meets different people like artists that she worked in Granada with, where that sort of collaboration just inevitably brings out a different way, a different perspective and a different way of looking at things and leads to all sorts of innovative outcomes.
To play devil's advocate for a second, if I'm a traditional thinking architect,
yes,
and I'm going, oh, why do I have to do all this collaboration? What was wrong with the model of procurement and delivery that we had previously? What is wrong with the traditional top-down single author model?
I don't think there's necessarily something wrong with it. It's probably just suited to a different time and place. And I think what we have now in architecture is a lot of things in our society are a lot more complex. There's a lot more regulation. There's a lot more complexity in the way the buildings are put together.
Yeah.
There's a lot more. They are difficult projects to get across the line. And I think, you know, when I'm always interested when people criticise bits of public work or architecture, that they fail to often recognise what the difficulties were that lay behind that. And I think Kettle Thorsen talked about it as architecture as negotiation, and that quite often that the actual design and the thinking behind what the building might be was only a really small component of what the actual delivery of it ends up being. And these projects may take on a couple of years of process of negotiation between a whole set of complex agencies and government authorities, and each one chipping away at the idea, budgets, building technologies, and you know, to deliver a really good building is actually a very difficult task. So the process of collaboration, Stuart, allows you to kind of negotiate those tricky minefields in a lot easier way. So it might be not necessarily there's anything wrong with that process of the top down authorship. That the idea of collaboration is just a lot more appropriate to where we are in time and place right now.
And I think I heard Don Bates, who's the director and co-founder of Lab Architecture Studio and Architects of Federation Square, saying similar things recently, that the design for Federation Square was very much about that negotiation. And I think that comes up particularly with large, or not necessarily large, but public buildings and public spaces.
Yeah, and I think Federation Square here in Melbourne, Christine, is a great example of that. Just to try and stitch together the discussion we're having at the start in relation to technology and this issue of collaboration, I think one way in which those two have overlapped in recent years is with programs like Skype, for example. And I think that, and having collaborated with you guys and Rory Hyde on the Venice Architecture Biennale works, which we'll talk about in the next show, that process was made a lot easier through technology,
yes,
through Skype,
true.
And I think and programs like that. And so I think there is a kind of sense that this distance issue has changed a lot, and you can now collaborate with people anywhere in the world, and people do. And Anna Tweeddale is a good example of that. But also file sharing and those kind of technologies enable, for the first time, really to be able to genuinely work off the same base of information and do that in an effective way. And we now, interestingly, do that ourselves for our radio work.
That's true. I think that's a really good point, Stuart. Communication digitally is really key to some of these collaborations.
And I think what we're finding is one of the real benefits of this is that in creative processes, people tend to develop sort of channels in which they think. They tend to kind of focus down to a kind of a particular way in which they do things. And if you bring other people into that process, it's where you start to challenge those orthodoxies and come up with new ideas and new ways to apply your thinking. The other kind of really innovative thing I think that's happening in the areas of design is this idea of design thinking. It's a term that's only really been sort of around in the last decade or so and has originated out of the States, as a lot of these concepts do. And this is an idea that perhaps architects and creative people are applying their modes of thinking can be applied to other things other than just the discipline in which they work. So other than just architecture or engineering or something like that, that we operate as architects in a particular way. There's a particular mode of thinking and a particular process we work through that can be applied to a number of other things. And that could be economics, it could be politics, it could be education.
Yeah, it's a way of thinking, and it doesn't necessarily involve design per se, but it would be fair to say design thinking, Simon, is a kind of branch of lateral thinking?
Yeah, I guess it goes back to those sort of Edward de Bono thing.
Yeah.
What hat are you wearing today, Stuart?
Well, spatial thinking is often talked about as well.
Or spatial intelligence, particularly.
Spatial intelligence, I think, does connect up to that idea of lateral thinking, which literally is a...
And I think anyone who's been in one of those creative processes and sort of particularly bogged down, you know, almost that sort of creative block when everyone's kind of thinking, well, we just can't really come up with a satisfactory answer to this problem. And you get someone who comes in completely from left field, you know, it could be, you know, who has no involvement in the process,
yeah,
just asks a particular question that hasn't been asked before.
Yeah,
and just throws the whole thing open and suddenly you kind of go off on a new trajectory.
Well, I think that's a good way of framing it is, you know, we can't come up with the answer, but maybe we're trying to answer the wrong question. I mean, it is often one of those things. And this whole conversation stitches into the notion, in terms of buzzwords, of integrated design, which is where you apply things like design thinking and creative processes. And it came up with the Anna Tweeddale interview at the start of a project, integrated into the development of brief, site, all these kind of things.
Yes.
You bring that at the start, and some of the work that's been happening in South Australia talks to this very strongly with the Integrated Design Commission that's just finished its initial project, which seeks to embody these important considerations at the start of a project and they're not just involved with people who are entirely outside of design disciplines.
Yes, because, Stuart, I mean, that is quite often a problem that we encounter in the architectural profession is that, and we talked to Anna about this and she's been strongly involved in this and you've been involved in this in your work in South Australia, is that when you come to design the building, when you're given the brief and you would think this is the start of the project, but there's actually a whole lot of stuff that's happened before and quite often these crucial decisions that have been made, and once they've been made and you're starting on the project, it's really hard to cover that ground.
And those decisions can be anything from, you know, where the site is, some overall massing stuff that might adversely affect something else. You know, these things are often not seen in a wider context, and context is key to these things, like both the spatial or context of the city, the piece of city that it's in, and the social context, the economic context. So considering these things in a wider picture, I think is part of design thinking, always thinking about context, whatever form of context.
And quite often, we're talking about sort of large-scale public commissions in that context, but it also happens, I think, quite often in residential design too, when clients come to you and they say, I want A, B and C in my house, I need these things, I need this, I need that. And when you actually sit down and interrogate them a little bit, or, you know, or elaborate the brief at those initial phases, you can quite often find something completely different, that their needs aren't actually what they thought it was. I mean, those might be, they're sort of driven from a kind of idea about real estate or resale rather than actually how they want to live in a house.
And I think this actually connects back to a conversation we had with Shelley Freeman from Make Architecture, when she said often she'll have a client come to her and, the you know, as an architect she can say, well, actually you don't need to extend your house, we can remodel what you already have and make it work in that way. So it can work on a whole lot of different levels, not just with large public buildings, but even with a small residential job. And it always leads back to that idea of problem solving and design thinking.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think so. The reason that maybe as practicing architects we get that experience at residential is because those projects are often simpler and you've got a direct involvement with the key stakeholders from the start, you can affect that change in terms of questioning the fundamentals of the brief.
That's right.
I think a brief needs to be designed in the same way a building needs to be designed. A good brief, an informed client, and then stakeholders that have buy-in and are participating will help lead to good outcomes across a variety of scales of projects. And I guess that other area which that touches on in terms of innovation is in terms of how projects happen now, is there's far more stakeholder engagement in projects now, community engagement, and that's a difference to the top-down author model where communities didn't tend to have a say. Now, good projects, particularly contentious ones, bring communities in, talk to them, find out what they want, also at very early stages as well. So it's not a process of going, well, this is what we're proposing, what do you reckon? It's like, well, what do you think needs to happen here? And there's some really good evidence that suggests that people, once they've been consulted, engaged with, have some sort of buy-in, even if the end product is not entirely what they thought it might be, if they've been involved in the process and they can understand the decision-making framework and why things need to be the way they are or why they've ended up that way, they end up thinking the project's good and they have ownership over it, and, you know, it's a far better outcome.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk to another concept that sort of came up through, and it's an elaboration of what we're talking about before, about the decreasing space of the world and the advent of technology and what that means in the way we can communicate. And this is this idea of architecture on the periphery. And I mean, traditionally, you know, particularly, you know, pre the last sort of 30 or 40 years, most of the architecture we've seen has come from fairly mainstream Europe, the United States, some from Scandinavia. But now we're starting to see, in particular over the last couple of years, a lot more architecture from more obscure places, and places like Australia are becoming more known on
Chile,
the international world. Chile's, you know,
Brazil.
Particularly South America. A lot of the Asian countries, so Korea, China, you know, Japan's always been a big player in architectural design, but we're seeing a lot more from Japan. And what that means, because I think, you know, when we see these practices coming in, a whole new kind of fresh approach to architecture, again, looking at things through a completely different set of eyes. And when we're exposed to that from other places around the world, you can see a whole lot of solutions being delivered, different solutions being delivered to quite complex projects.
That's right. And I think we can probably partially blame critics and authors of some of our key architecture histories from the sort of early to mid 20th century for leaving out a lot of these really interesting peripheral architectures. And now that we have these great internet communication tools, it means that, you know, people like us in little Melbourne or other parts of Australia can actually get stuff out there into the international arena. And we can start seeing things that are happening in other peripheral countries, which is just an amazing tool.
Yeah, I think it's been an amazing year, actually, because the world has been changing every week, essentially, through social media and other things. It's very, very rapid state of change. We unfortunately have to wrap up today's show right there. That's all we've got time for, with myself, Stuart Harrison, Simon Knott and Christine Phillips. You've been listening to The Architects on RN. Next time, we're going to be looking at the international scene in a bit more depth, talking about the Venice Biennale and Pritzker Prize winner Wang Shu. More info on that and this week's show on the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.
And don't forget, you can listen to All Things Design on By Design here on RN with Penella Kernabone throughout summer.